Egypt and Saudi Arabia supporting the Sudanese armed forces side, the UAE, though it denies it, supporting the rapid support forces side. And, you know, this is not a comfortable thing for the US in their vision for the Middle East. So they've brought those together in a format called the Quad and have actually managed to get them to agree wording for a roadmap. And they're now in the process of trying to convert those fine words into actual action and implementation. And as long as the US can keep their attention focused on it and can work the detail and not just go for a photo opportunity and a signing, but get the complicated detail necessary for ceasefire management, et cetera, then we could just be at the beginning of the end.
Well, let's hope so, and let's hope there's some progress. Nick Kay, former British ambassador to Sudan, thank you for coming on and giving us your expertise. We need to do more on this, and I hope we can come back and hear your expertise again. That's it for me today. I'll be back at 1 p.m. tomorrow. But up next on Times Radio, it's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon. It is 2 o'clock. It's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover here on Times Radio until four.
And in those 2 hours, hundreds of head teachers are calling for phones to be banned in schools. Has the Parents Forum Mumsnet got a solution by building their own smartphone? Britain's building future will require us all to do our bit, says Rachel Reeves, as she refuses to rule out tax rises. The Sunday Times economics editor will tell us what that could look like. Germany's young people are kicking out at new plans for conscription. Could it ever return here? We're going to debate that one later. And our big interview is with the historian, and now we call him Celebrity Traitors star, David Olusoga. Let's start with the news at two. Stuart Willey.
Jane, thank you. Good afternoon. The Chancellor has laid the groundwork for potential tax rises, warning that each of us must do our bit. In a speech, Rachel Reeves said her promise to meet fiscal rules is ironclad. That prompted a fall in government borrowing costs as well as the value of the pound. James Smith, research director at the left-leaning Resolution Foundation think tank, told Times Radio the Chancellor will need to avoid picking fights with small groups of taxpayers.
Doing something on income tax makes it a bigger change. Bringing down national insurance is a reforming move. It's protecting working people. And there's justification, I think, for taxing other groups, particularly asset holders, particularly pensioners who have really benefited from, for example, the triple lock and who have had much better growth in their living standards.
The Times' defence editor has given evidence to MPs over her legal battle with the government to report a data leak revealing the details of Afghans who helped British forces. Larissa Brown was prevented from reporting on the leak for nearly 2 years because of a Ministry of Defence super injunction. She says she couldn't warn Afghans she'd worked with to get them out of the country.
You know, I'd be speaking to these people and I knew that their names potentially were on a list of thousands of people, and at any point the Taliban could get hold of their names and come knocking at their door. And that was really difficult for me, and I knew that I couldn't tell them about it, and they didn't know. They didn't know for the whole of this time that their names were on this list.
The Defence Secretary has since said he's deeply uncomfortable with the secrecy around the case. Tommy Robinson has been found not guilty of a terror offence for failing to cooperate with police. The hard-right activist, whose real name is Stephen Yaxley Lennon, didn't give officers the code to his mobile phone when he was stopped at the Channel Tunnel in Folkestone last July. The family of the railway staff member who confronted a knife attacker on a train in Cambridgeshire say they're immensely proud of him. Samir Zitouni remains in a critical condition after the mass stabbings on Saturday night. Dick Cheney, the powerful former US vice president who served under George W. Bush, has died at the age of 84. The conservative was best known for the so-called War on Terror, but later came to criticize the Trump-era Republican Party. His family say he passed away due to pneumonia, as well as cardiac and vascular disease. The longtime Sunday Times journalist Sarah Baxter observed Cheney up close in Washington.
This is a man who survived 5 heart attacks and yet still exuded an air of power and menace. He believed in a strong presidency and was criticized for encouraging Bush to push the bounds of the presidency. But he really is redolent of another era where you could be hard right, staunch Republican, but opposed to the populism now sweeping through our politics.
And the number of people who vape has overtaken the number who smoke for the first time. New figures suggest 10% of adults in Britain use e-cigarettes every day or occasionally, compared with just over 9% using cigarettes. For a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Hello, good afternoon. Jane Garvey, Fee Glover. We're here on Times Radio until 4 o'clock. We'd love you to take part. You did yesterday. You were brilliant yesterday. All sorts of fiery opinions expressed via the WhatsApp number, which is 0333 003 2353. So today on the programme, what do you think about that idea? Would you get your offspring the new child-friendly smartphone? Whatever happened to that money supposedly raised by the sale of Chelsea Football Club? Money that was supposed to be going to victims of the war in Ukraine. New York is going to the polls to elect a new mayor. Could the Big Apple soon be run by a socialist? And what on earth will the Big Orange make of that? Conscription could be gradually reintroduced, we're told, in Germany. Now, there are often calls for the return of national service here, so we're going to have a fiery debate later featuring a retired colonel and the current president of the National Union of Students. And we'll talk about the NHS as well. The doctor strike starts in a week or so. Flu already very much with us and having quite the impact on the NHS, even in early November. It's not going to get any better, is it, anytime soon? So that's the health news with Dr. Rachel Ward coming your way a little later. And the big guest, Fee, is
Professor David Olusoga. He's got so much going on. He is about to launch a new TV series about empire. He is on tour at the moment talking about missing people from history. He's got an upcoming tour next year, which is going to tell the story of various parts of our history through the guns that we used at the time. So you've got muskets and you've got handguns all the way through to revolvers. And it's a clever way of doing it. I don't know about you, but I've never actually seen a gun that you can fire at close range. So to go along to an evening's entertainment and see him with all of those on stage, I think might be quite chilling, and deliberately so. And obviously, he's a celebrity traitor, so we are going to talk about traitors. I think the final comes our way, doesn't it, this week, in probably about 72 hours' time. So he couldn't give too much away, but we do talk about some of the egos involved in the castle.
Right. He's in the final, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
Yeah,
he's made it all the way there by being very, very thoughtful.
What was the very good line that our colleague Hugo
Well, Hugo had? Rifkin said he's been incredibly thoughtful, very intellectual. He's brought an awful lot of brain cells to the party, and he's also been wrong every time.
It's actually been quite compelling. So he's a great special guest, and you can hear him after 3:30 this afternoon. Brief look at the most read stories on the Times website this afternoon. At number three, David Beckham receives knighthood at Windsor Castle. The former England captain, recognised for his services to sport in the King's birthday honours. The second most read story is Kate Clancy, I Was Cancelled. It made me contemplate suicide. When the author and academic wrote about the children she'd been teaching, she was completely unprepared for the furore that broke out. Now, after 4 years, her publisher has apologised. Andrew Billen has interviewed Kate Clancy for The Times, and lots of you are reading that. The most read piece on The Times website is Rachel Reeves' speech, Chancellor paves way for tax rises. That is the Times live politics page. It gives you all the reaction to this morning's speech, of course, and we'll talk about that later with David Smith of the Sunday Times. All of these articles are on thetimes.com. You'll need a digital subscription, and you can get one by going to thetimes.com/subscribe.
Right, let's set sail into the news then. Hundreds of head teachers are calling for a full statutory ban on smartphones in schools. A letter to the Education Secretary says phones phones help fuel harmful content, sexual abuse, bullying, and make it simply harder for children to learn. Well, the online forum Mumsnet has long campaigned for safer and smarter ways for kids to use their phones, and it's now taken matters into its own hands. It's helped to build and is helping to market a new child-friendly smartphone. It lets parents restrict what their kids can do and see, but in a different way, not by physically removing or banning apps from a phone or employing endless parental control systems, but by using clever AI technology to give parents remote access and control of the phone, and most importantly, what's coming into it. I spoke to Mumsnet's co-founder and executive chair, Justine Roberts, a little earlier, and I started by asking her to explain a bit more about how this phone really works.
Our phone, it's known as the Other Phone, and it is the first real attempt, I think, to design with parents and safe children's safety in mind. So we've produced a smartphone which is really high quality tech because we've got a really cool hardware partner called Nothing. And we've got a layer of safety first software on top of that, produced by a company called Safety Mode, which is powered by AI, and it allows parents to really implement controls, have complete oversight of what their kids are doing. So you can decide as a parent whether you want social media apps or not, at what age you want to add them. And there's also an AI filter of all the content that appears on the phone. So even for things like WhatsApp messages, if there is harmful content in those, they are blocked and the parent is flagged. So it's a completely different level of oversight. It's designed to be a first smartphone. You can add all the apps you want, but the parent has the pass key that allows them to decide which apps. You can put time limits on, and you can filter for content. So in all areas, it's really simple to use. We've tested it with kids and parents. The kids aren't able to override the blocks and the filters. Even Hugh Grant and his family tested it, and they said their kids, who are really tech savvy, couldn't override it because he's quite interested in this space.
Right. It's a very interesting guinea pig family to have, Justine.
Well, it wasn't the only guinea pig family, but he is a big skeptic about this subject, so we wanted them to really try and crack it. And it's just the difference is it's also like has no addictive features. You know, even the home page is incredibly bland because, you know, smartphones have been built with one aim in mind, and social media apps have been built with one aim in mind, and that is to get as maximum use out of it as possible so data can be collected and more ads can be sold to your kid.
So am I right in thinking, Justine, that actually the main difference between the phone that you have created and other phones that are available on the market is this ability that the parents will have to control the phone from a distance? Because obviously you can get a phone for your child and you can be in charge of what's on it, because if you retain your own passcodes, you can simply look at the phone and do what it is that you want to do with it. So you're saying that this phone means that, you know, if I'm in the office and I had a kid who was about to see something inappropriate, I would be made aware of that.
You would, but I would also say about the other filters and controls on other phones, they are not effective. So 3/4 of parents on Mumsnet say that they think keeping their child safe online right now is impossible. And, you know, that they're both because they'll be exposed to harmful content, but also because the blocks are very crude. So you either say you can have this thing or you can't have this thing. Whereas what we've introduced is a layer of AI-driven software that actually filters, you know, what's on the phone. So if you might say to yourself, look, I want my kids to be able to talk to their friends. So I want them to be able to have WhatsApp groups and, you know, whatever. But within that, there can be quite bullying messages. So our phone filters what's actually in the content and blocks it and flags it according to the settings that the parents put in the first place.
Right. And just on that tip then, Justine, how is that possible? Because WhatsApp is selling itself on end-to-end encryption, isn't it? How can you be able to see what's in those messages with that encryption on them?
Okay, now, I apologise, I'm not a tech expert here, but it's screen reading software. So the basic premise is that we will take a picture or a screen reading of what's on it, and there's an automatic, instantaneous block on things that are viewed to be bullying or aggressive. And the parent gets to set the sort of level of kind of effectiveness of those filters. So you could have a high rating for that or a low rating for that or whatever.
And Justine, how surprised and annoyed should we be that tech companies themselves haven't built a phone like this, that parents would be happy to allow their children to use?
I am actually very surprised. I think, you know, there's no reason why you couldn't have different pieces of hardware for different age groups. And, you know, I can only think that a lot of the tech companies are, you know, they are also the people making the apps. But it is surprising. I mean, Google has Family Link, and that has some validity, and it actually works in tandem with our phone, so you can integrate Family Link if you're already a Family Link user. They just haven't made it their focus. It's not their key, that I guess they don't think it's a key profit driver. And if I'm honest, Fee, we're not really doing this to make a lot of money. We're doing it because we, you know, if we break even and sell a load of phones, we'll be delighted.
Yeah, but so many parents, they don't want to be part of that kind of profiteering from the phone companies and the app companies anyway. You know, I think most of us are very aware of the extraordinary profits that are being made by these companies. And it adds to our distress, actually, doesn't it? When we think, well, you've got the money, so you could be spending that money on making our kids safer.
Yeah, I think parents are in a pretty impossible position at the moment because they have the choice of either restricting their kids' kind of really ability to exist in the world as it is now, because you need phones for everything from travel to homework to obviously social life. But knowing at the same time that they put one of these devices in their hands, they are compromising their kids' safety and potentially well-being, because of the number of addictive by design apps that there are out there and, you know, the amount of harmful content that there is out there. So it's an impossible situation. And the idea of trying to restrict, you know, usage when something is, you've got the brightest minds in the world focused on keeping our kids' attention in this device. You know, they are working day in, day out to try and keep our kids addicted to these things. So how we expect families to be the police of this? Yes, you can. I mean, it's so easy to say, well, parents can just say no. But the implication of saying no is that you socially isolate your child. And trying to put time limits on is a constant battle. And that's what mums don't users tell us. They're in this constant battle of trying to be a parent who, you know, understands that children need to navigate the digital world, have access to their friends, etc., etc., but they're trying to protect their sort of developing brains from the constant dopamine hits and stuff like that. So it's just a battle, family life, and we're just trying to attack that by allowing a really easy way for parents to be in charge again.
Sure.
Really.
And what does this phone look like, Justine? And is it in danger of being the equivalent of trying to send your kid to school in very nice T-bar shoes when everybody else is in Air Force Ones?
Well, we've purposely, this is partly why we partnered with Nothing, who are a very cool UK independent tech brand that are taking on Apple.
Yeah, so do you know what? The name of their company is confusing, though, isn't it, for the purposes of radio? When you see it in print with an uppercase letter. When, the first time you said it, I thought, oh, gosh, this interview's not going well. She doesn't know what she's talking about.
Apologies for that. I think that is part of, I mean, you know.
Oh, no, they're hip. They're groovy. Yeah.
Far be it from me, a 57-year-old woman, to tell anyone what's cool or not, but I think the name is part of the coolness, and we have tried to go with that by calling our phone the other phone, which hopefully will appeal to kids. But as a piece of tech, it looks like a smartphone. All the sort of interface is very, very cool and it's very high performance. So you're not compromising on that bit. The only bit that, I mean, you know, in the end, it's really impossible to break through the filters. So, but the great thing about this phone is you can relax the filters as you feel your child is maturing, getting more responsible. You can add more apps. You can, reduce the safety filters. So it can grow with your child. But as a first phone, I think, the choice, I think, for today's parents is how late can they wait to do this? And it would be marvellous if we had a government that legislated to protect our kids and as they've done in Australia, put limits on ages and things like that. But that doesn't look like it's going to happen. So meantime, parents have to exist in the real world.
Yeah, and this is going to help them to do it. Just because you've mentioned the government there and what you would like from the government, the Chancellor delivered a speech this morning, which is widely seen as pitching for tax cuts. What do you and Mumsnet users most want to hear from Rachel Reeves in the upcoming budget?
Look, everyone on Mumsnet, it's a big question. Everyone's struggling with the cost of living, with inflation, with the fact that their incomes in real terms seem to be going down and the price of everything is going up. So I think, I think the message that it's tough, there are tough choices probably has got through. And I think it's about, the people want everyone to pay their fair share. So we'll see what tax rises she comes up with. But I think the majority on Mumsnet would feel that they want the billionaires to pay more. And they'd like to, feel that there was some progress in bringing inflation down.
Justine Roberts, co-founder of Mumsnet. So the other phone is available. When you were choosing smartphones for your kids, I mean, I know this may have been back in the last century, Joan, I just can't tell.
Smartphones had been invented.
Yeah, so I think it was very difficult to know what it was that you were enabling your children to have. We are so much better informed now, but actually the choice isn't that great. So I find it astonishing that it has taken Mumsnet to come up with a phone, which I think by the sounds of it, I would have been very happy to give to my kids when they were younger, because I would retain my confidence that I could kind of see into it, because that's the danger, isn't it? You lose sight of what it is that your kids are able to see. And our generation simply has not been technologically literate enough to know our way round parental controls and when the kids can override them and all of that type of stuff.
I can't be the only parent who had to ask a child how to set up the parental
controls. There you go. There you go. So the other phone may well have been for you. I might get you one.
Thanks very much. Right. Isn't it lovely, David Beckham being knighted?
It is. It's great.
Doesn't it look smart?
It's great news for everybody. I have to say that Victoria Beckham was there at the ceremony and she looks absolutely beautiful, but she stands in that kind of model way.
Well, one foot in front of the other,
which I always do when I need a wee. So I hope that wasn't the case.
Right. And you'll be able to see those images on thetimes.com right now. Well, not anyway, you know what I mean. When Roman Abramovich sold Chelsea, the proceeds were meant to go to victims of the war in Ukraine. Well, more than 3 years on, where is that money? Where has that money gone? That's next here on Times Radio. This is Jane and Fee with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Global events.
There's a warning that the impact of climate change is getting more severe and we're not prepared.
Breaking news.
Following allegations of potential fraud raised by the Times.
Reactive analysis.
What's going on in the government about discussion of extremism?
From the world's best journalists.
We're trying to look at some of the questions about migration and the implications for the economy, jobs and public services.
On DAB, online, on the app and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
This is the sound of learning in India. A healthy dose of happiness in South Sudan. And a full tummy in Hertfordshire. Poverty, conflict and the climate crisis are hitting children hard. Save the Children operate in the UK and over 100 countries worldwide, helping the next generation to stay safe, healthy and learning. By leaving a gift in your will, you'll help fund our life-saving work, giving children around the world more reasons to laugh. Gifts in wills allow us to respond quickly when disaster strikes. They help us to deliver vital healthcare. They give children the chance to heal emotional wounds, to rebuild confidence, to laugh and smile again. At Save the Children, we believe childhood shouldn't just be survived, but enjoyed. And for us, nothing says success like this. Help to give children the best start in life by leaving a gift in your will. Search Save the Children, Gifts in Wills. Save the Children is a registered charity.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms. Ready to start your next home project? This autumn at Wix, there are great kitchen and bathroom offers available. Explore the ranges at wix.co.uk or visit the showroom in your local Wix store.
Just been given a mug of tea that's, it's tough going. Have you seen it? The shade of the brew. It's robust, I'll say that. But I'm very grateful for it. I don't want to moan. Now, the Times reports exclusively today on fears that less than half of the cash raised from the forced sale of Chelsea Football Club will actually get to victims of the war in Ukraine. The club was previously owned, as you'll know, by the Russian-born billionaire Roman Abramovich, who was sanctioned by the British government after Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022. Newly published company accounts suggest that £923 million would go to charity, with more than £1.5 billion being used to pay off loans from Abramovich-owned companies. Martin Ziegler is chief sports reporter for The Times. This seems completely unjust, Martin. How has it happened?
Yeah, it's a very strange one. We know that it's 3.5 years after the sale of Chelsea. Virtually no money at all has gone to this charitable foundation. And the government has talked about going to court to try and force this through. But the expectation all the time was that there was going to be £2.3 billion going to the victims of the war in Ukraine. What the company accounts of this firm called Fordstam, which is owned by Roman Abramovich, which have come out today, shows is that actually they're talking about only the net proceeds of the sale and after the balance items have been cleared from the company accounts. Now, those balance items are basically £1.4 billion being repaid to Abramovich for money he loaned.
To the company he co-owns or owns.
Correct, the company he owns, yes.
To most of us, this is just an absolutely baffling world, and it seems deeply unjust. It is, isn't it?
Well, I think there's certainly questions for when the government at the time, 2022, we're talking about, when it agreed to allow the sanctioned Abramovich to sell Chelsea and basically bank the money, which he has done. It's still in his company's accounts, even though they're frozen. Did they realise that he was going to just talk about the net proceeds, or were they under the impression it was going to be the full £2.3 billion? If they thought it was going to be £2.3 billion, I think somebody's made a big mistake somewhere, because that does not appear to be what Abramovich thinks. And, you know, we've got this impasse now. It's been going on for ages, and there seems to be no sign of it being resolved.
So there's actually no sign even of that relatively small amount of over 900 million going to the victims, never mind the rest of it.
That's right. Well, that is also bogged down in another dispute. The government has said it can only be spent on humanitarian projects within Ukraine. Abramovich is insisting that it must go to victims of the war everywhere.
Yeah.
Now, that may be because he's under pressure, perhaps. He's a bit worried about antagonising the Kremlin. He's had issues before when he thought he was poisoned when he was taking part in some sort of peace talks. So he's probably quite careful and worried about his own personal safety. So I think he's treading a fine line too.
Well, I think a lot of people will understand that. And I must admit, the British government must presumably be very keen for the money to go only to Ukrainian victims. But you can understand why Abramovich, as you say, might be under pressure to, at least in public, say something rather different.
Yes, I think that is the problem. I mean, this charitable foundation has been set up. There is a guy called Mike Penrose who used to work for UNICEF. He's running it, but he's basically the only employee and has been for the last 3.5 years. And nothing's happened. I mean, it's very frustrating for him, I'm sure. All these projects which could be funded, which aren't being. And another question, I guess, is what happens if there is peace between Russia and Ukraine? What will happen to the money then? If Abramovich stops being a sanctioned individual, is that frozen bank account unfrozen? He can do with it what he wants? That's another question which we don't know the answer to.
Now, your story's only really relatively recently gone online. So any word from the British government about what it can do about this?
Not yet. I've contacted them this morning and I'm waiting for a response to that, which hopefully we'll get later today.
And the club itself, any impact on them? Different owners now, but what about the club?
The one interesting thing from the accounts is it confirms that they withheld £150 million from the purchase price because they had uncovered some suspect payments regarding player transfers, payments to agents, effectively, which had kind of gone under the radar, off the books. The FA last month charged Chelsea with 74 breaches of regulations because of that. So they could end up perhaps... A large chunk of that £150 million could be a financial penalty for those infractions.
But that was something that is alleged to have happened under the Abramovich regime.
That's correct.
So-called, yes.
Yes, so they discovered the payments during the takeover process. And although it's new owners, the club is still an entity which is liable for disciplinary sanctions from the Football Association, even going back to the previous ownership.
Right. I think listeners will probably be not that shocked that there are some murky, allegedly murky activities in football at the top level. Would you say about that?
Player agents, I think, and murky go hand in hand, don't they? I mean, there are some very, very reputable players agents, but there's I think three at least of the transfers took place involving Russian clubs and some unusual Russian intermediaries involved. And yes, I think it's fair to say it's not, they wouldn't be your normal licensed FA agent.
Deep waters. OK, Martin, thank you very much indeed. Appreciate your time. Martin Ziegler, Chief Sports Reporter for The Times. And if you're a fan of Chelsea or indeed just interested in football, that story is online at thetimes.com right now.
I admire the way that you both very professionally tap danced around that last topic. It was a masterclass in what wasn't being said.
Well, there you go.
The orange one sets up for a battle in the Big Apple. What will the New York mayoral race mean for American politics? That's where we'll go next. It's just gone 2:30. Let's get the latest news first with Stuart Willey.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Fee, thank you. Good afternoon. Rachel Reeves has blamed poor productivity, rising national debt and what she calls a rushed and ill-conceived Brexit as she prepares for possible manifesto-breaking tax rises. The Chancellor has taken the unusual step of a pre-budget speech in Downing Street, where government debt was one of her key focuses. The government has confirmed Sir Alan Bates has settled his compensation claim over the post office IT scandal. It's understood he's accepted a multi-million pound offer. Online pornography showing women being choked is going to be banned in England and Wales. The government's concerned strangulation is becoming a sexual norm. £2 million worth of gold and jewellery has been seized in what's thought to be a record for Greater Manchester Police. Two men were arrested at Manchester Airport on suspicion of money laundering. And David Beckham has been knighted by the King at Windsor Castle. Sir David says the honour for services to sport and charity is his proudest moment.
I've been lucky to have won things in my career and done things and played for my country and captained my country. But without doubt, this is the moment that makes me very proud. For a number of reasons, not just obviously my career, to get it for the philanthropic work that I do, you know, that's so important to me.
He wore a grey morning suit, which he says was made by his wife, Lady Victoria. Others recognised include Elaine Page and Roger Daltrey of The Who. Don't forget, you can set the Times News Briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
Add water to your will. And know that from that single drop, life will grow. Communities will flourish. A better world will be left. By leaving a gift in your will to WaterAid, you'll help bring essential clean water to people who need it, to change their own lives for generations to come. Add WaterAid to your will. Search WaterAid Legacy to find out how.
Here's to the moment. To the places that give you perspective and the people who change that perspective. The curiosity that leads you to the edge of the earth and the joy that meets you there. Silver Sea brings you closer to the rare, the remote, and the remarkable. On spacious yet intimate ships that show you what most miss. Here's to having every reason to celebrate. To finding more. Learn more at silversea.com.
Okay, that's six of the ragu and the linguine. Make a move, everyone, please.
The customers are rolling in at Stefano's new restaurant, so he needs another chef. Someone with a cool head and an appetite for success.
More flour in the bechamel, let's go.
Indeed can help him find great people fast.
I need Indeed.
Indeed you do. Sponsor a job on Indeed to unlock more tools that save you time and help you hire quality candidates. To start hiring, visit indeed.com/try today.
Get a first look at tomorrow morning's front pages. Tonight from 10 with Carol Walker on Times Radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in bathroom design and installation. Transform your bathroom. Book a free home visit and measure, and then let the Wix design experts help you choose from thousands of products. Book a free bathroom design appointment at wix.co.uk.
It is 26 minutes to three. John Pienaar is taking over from us at 4 o'clock this afternoon. Where will you start, John?
I will start, Fee, with the economy, with the Chancellor's speech, rare as it was, and pretty much, you know, arguably devoid of anything new, nothing we didn't know. I mean, headline, we're going to get tax increases in the budget. And then I see in the next moment there's a YouGov poll that says well over 60% of people think there's going to be tax rises in the budget, and have thought that for a long time, and they were right. You know, we've absolutely been expecting that. But I'm going to be looking at that and trying to disentangle the economics of this from the politics, because a lot of what Rachel Reeves said today was true. You know, there are economic headwinds. Tariffs are blowing against us. This government did inherit a miserable looking balance sheet from the last government, but it's also true that Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer ducked some of the really difficult questions and obvious facts, like the impact of Brexit, we're hearing about now, as if it was the first time we've heard it, which it isn't, and other things too, the likelihood of tax cuts, which just about everyone knew were coming. So I'm going to be putting some of that apart and then trying to chuck it forward the way that we do, and to see where on earth we're going to end up. I'm talking to Larissa Brown, the defence editor of the Times, about her evidence to the Defence Committee at Westminster today. She's talking about that leak of the Afghan data, which didn't just put a lot of Afghans at risk. It seems, according to some reliable reporting, to have resulted in the death of 49 of them. We'll hear what Larissa had to say to that committee. I'm going to be talking about, well, the fascinating thing in America, where you've got Donald Trump at odds with the Pentagon, and let alone his own energy secretary, about whether or not they're going to begin nuclear testing in America. That's got all sorts of huge questions to do with the new arms race, to do with environmental damage, and some good news about AI. There's a new AI technique which will help to detect skin cancer much quicker. So there we go. It's not all gloom.
No. John, thank you very much indeed. Just on the nuclear testing and nuclear arms, actually, have you seen House of Dynamite, the film by Catherine Bigelow?
No, the team mentioned House of Dynamite, something I need to see.
You should see it, actually. I think anybody who's got an interest in current affairs would benefit from watching that. It's not a fun watch.
Is it a conspiracy theory?
No, not at all, but it's tracking the path of a nuclear attack in real time, and we never really find out who the attack is from, but it is astonishing.
depressingly informative. Now, I don't think anyone would really mind that, but it is a really, really good watch because, you know, when we talk about nuclear arms, when we talk about nuclear testing, actually, people can zone out a little bit because, fortunately, we have not experienced the full wallop of nuclear arms and what they can do, but it is. I'd give that a hard recommend. Yes. You look a little bit disturbed.
No,
this.
No, I've seen it.
Have you seen it?
It's not as frightening as Threads, but then nothing is.
Okay, right. You've got stuck on Threads, though.
I really have.
For about the last 20 years.
Well, more than that. 1987, I think.
40 years. Okay. Really, so you're looking for something really, truly awful
House
to dislodge
of Dynamite
it.
Is like a rom com. And I mean it.
Okay. Well, I really enjoyed watching it. I thought it was very informative. New Yorkers are going to the polls today for an election that could define both the city and one of America's two political parties. The Democrat candidate is Sohrab Mamdani, a charismatic left-winger. He's favoured to win despite the senior echelons of his party not rowing in behind him. Against him is former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, running as an independent and endorsed by Donald Trump. He is tarnished by multiple allegations of sexual misconduct and his record during COVID. And the Republican candidate, Curtis Sliwa, doggedly refused to drop out and is expecting to get about 20% of the vote. Sydney Blumenthal is a journalist and former senior advisor to Bill and Hillary Clinton. A very good afternoon from us. Would you care to predict how this race is going to finish?
Well, Mamdani is going to win, and the question is whether he'll cross a majority. There are elections across the United States today, very important ones. It's the first election day in a year since Trump was elected, and this is, in effect, a referendum on Trump and his referendum. And his experiment. He's very, very unpopular. His unpopularity is greater than it was after January 6th, which was his low point in his first term. And that contributes to the rise of Mamdani in New York City. He's had a harmonic convergence of factors and favorable to him, including, of course, Trump, but also running against Andrew Cuomo, who carries an entire wagon train of baggage. There's a Prince Andrew problem on both sides of the Atlantic, as you pointed out, with charges of sexual misconduct. And Trump endorsed Cuomo yesterday, which was, in New York City, the kiss of death.
What does New York City look like if Mamdani is wildly successful? What does it look like if he spectacularly fails?
He's young. He's relatively inexperienced. He serves in the state assembly. He's charming. He's articulate. He's intelligent. We'll see who he brings into his administration. It's being mayor of New York City is always a pretty near impossible job. Almost everybody sort of fails at it. Bloomberg did well in part because he spent his own money. But it's a very hard job. It's going to be very hard for him to enact his full program. The question for Mamdani is how he does in practice as opposed to in theory.
Okay. And Donald Trump, his threat to Mamdani is to reduce funding. How low can he go?
He can try and withhold federal funds from the city for various programs, but that's a relatively small amount as compared to withholding funds federally from a state in the United States. And his attacks on Mamdani will help make Mamdani a popular mayor and lend him support along the way. Trump is Mamdani's best political ally.
Right. Where have other Democrat voters in this contest looked if to them Mamdani has just seemed a bit too much?
Well, the A lot of the real estate developers have supported Andrew Cuomo. Cuomo is a very tarnished figure, and he's never been ahead. He blew the primary. He was complacent. He ran a campaign about himself, about his own competence as governor of New York. Remember, however, that he was forced to resign amidst charges of sexual misconduct and mishandling the COVID crisis. So he is a flawed candidate, and the Republican candidate is well known for decades as a crank in New York. He's very amusing. He's a real New York character. People like him for his entertainment value, but he is not a serious political figure. So here we are in New York City. But there are other very important races across the country, governorships in Virginia, New Jersey, a big referendum on redistricting in California, three Supreme Court justices in Pennsylvania. And I predict the Democrats are going to sweep. The only question is, how large are their margins? Right. And this is a referendum on Trump and what he's done.
And so talk us through what we know about Trump's dive in the polls. I think there was a CNN poll, wasn't there, very recently, which took down his approval rating from in the 60% to 37%. To what would you attribute that massive dive? I mean, we love to criticise Trump over here, and we like to, I don't know, sit on our high horse a little bit about what we see as his failings, but they're often so different to what Americans feel his failings or his successes might be.
Chiefly, he has failed on the economic front. He was elected very narrowly by about 1.5, 1.8%. And he claimed a mandate. He's seized emergency powers that are now before the courts. Especially on tariffs. His tariffs have had a drastic effect on the economy. They've driven up inflation. That broke his chief promise to the voters that he was going to reduce inflation. The voters voted for him by that narrow margin, including all kinds of marginal groups on the basis that he would improve their economic situation, and he has failed so far. But there's not a single issue across the board on which he has majority support. He has negative disapproval on every issue, including immigration, and especially on how he's handling immigration with the ICE raids on the cities. People really, really dislike it and see MAGA, it as the beginning of a police state.
Sure. But Mr. Blumenthal, I mean, his MAGA fan base would point to all of those things and applaud him for them. I mean, presumably he has ticked boxes, particularly with ICE, for people who really wanted immigration to change in America.
Well, that base is now under, is about 30% or under in the country. And we're having elections for the first time. Northwest, east and south, east and west. And we're going to see what the judgment is on Trump's program. The Republicans, who will face a midterm election a year from now, will be staring if the election returns result in a big credit sweep into the abyss themselves with Trump not on the ballot. They are on the ballot.
Why can the Democrats seem to, why do the Democrats seem to find it so difficult to punt charismatic, successful candidates made in their own likeness at the moment? Because the Democrat candidate here in New York, Mr. Mamdani, does not really represent most Democrats. You know, he's a charismatic left-winger described by some as a Marxist. And it would seem to be that the Democrat Party does have this void. Why would that be?
Well, there are two candidates running in other states. Gail Kinberger and in Virginia and New Jersey, respectively. And they are both with military backgrounds. They're not charismatic, and yet the voters seem to like them. So it depends on where you are and, in terms of the support that you get from the electorate. Mondani is a very unique character. He's charming. He's articulate. He's also very controversial. But he's a he will be a mayor of New York. Mayors of New York don't even win statewide office. He may be projected as a boogeyman nationally and even as a national candidate for the left wing. But mayors in New York don't become elected national sure. figures, much less New York statewide figures.
So, Sydney, we're losing your line a little bit, and our apologies to our listeners for that. But the Democrat candidates who you have mentioned in those other states, are they names that we should look out for in future?
I think that they're, the question is whether they'll be successful governors. The presidential race, well, is a kind of shadow race right now and won't become apparent until a year from now after the midterm elections, when you will have a presidential nominating contest in earnest and people will declare their candidacies. But between now and a year from now, what we're looking at are the midterm congressional elections and whether or not the Democrats can gain control of one or both of the chambers, the House and the Senate, and provide a check and balance and investigation yeah. of Donald Trump.
We are a long way out. Thank you very much indeed for your time this afternoon. Sydney Blumenthal is a journalist, former senior advisor to Bill and Hillary Clinton. I mean, it did seem extraordinary last week that we were considering the possibility that Kamala Harris would come back into the fray ahead of the next presidential race. There must be other names.
What's this? Bin says, I'm no Trump lover, but the idea that he only narrowly beat Kamala Harris is for the birds. But it's not, is it? Statistically, it was only a narrow victory. I know it depends how you look at the results and at the figures involved, but in pure who voted for who percentage terms, it was a relatively narrow win. That is true, isn't it?
It is, Jane. Yeah.
Some people don't seem willing to accept it.
Although you can go smoke and mirrors with the American electoral system.
Do anything.
He can, yeah.
And Becky says that at the House of Dynamite, which is on Netflix now, was in the cinema briefly, now it's just on Netflix, just doesn't have an ending. But I think the truth, Becky, the terrible truth is, I just don't think they had the budget for what would be a pretty unpleasant ending. So they left us sort of guessing, didn't they? But I thought it was rather compelling, the end, actually. It made you stop and think.
Yeah, I made an assumption about the ending.
Well, I think I did too. It wasn't good. Right. How many doctors earn more than the Prime Minister? It's Health News Time. Dr. Rachel Ward standing by. That's next here on Times Radio. Jane and Fee with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
The Evening Edition with Kate Borsay on Times Radio with the new Volkswagen California camper van. Embark on an evening expedition, rounding up the latest news and previewing tomorrow's headlines. Plus, don't miss Hit the Road, your essential weekly travel guide to the best destinations across the UK and beyond. Every Monday to Thursday night from 7 on Times Radio with the new Volkswagen California camper van. Designed for every adventure. Search New Volkswagen California to find out more.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Amazon offers term time working to their employees, like Anton, who's home to look after his daughters during their holidays.
Hello!
To him, this is the best sound in the world. Actually, maybe that's the best sound of all. Now that's term time working. Offered at Amazon. 10 weeks off guaranteed per year. Mix of paid holiday and unpaid time off. Conditions apply.
When they say, don't get me anything, you know what they really mean. Give the birthday gift they really want from Hotel Chocolat. Cakes transformed into chocolate for those who choose dessert over a starter. Or, if they like it nutty, a box bursting with pralines and epically crunchy whole nut chocolates. Add a gift bag and a complimentary gift sleeve, and make it a birthday moment. Find the gift you know they'll love in store or online at Hotel Chocolat.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
We're just going to briefly revisit the American presidential result.
So we're talking about the popular vote here to avoid the smoke and mirrors. And Kamala Harris got 48.3% of the popular vote. That's over 75 million votes. And Donald Trump got 49.8% of the popular vote. That is just over 77 million. So in those terms, it was a cat's whisker, really.
Pretty much.
If you then look to the seats, they are different because the Electoral College operates on a very different system, and we don't have the time to explain that, Jane.
The seminar has got to end right there. But thank you very much indeed. Now, a third of GPs...
Welcome to our own Super Tuesday. Never got that either.
No. A third of GPs earn more than the Prime Minister. This is according to official figures released by the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting. He hopes this data will increase pressure on the doctors' union to reverse its opposition to online reforms. Let's welcome Dr. Rachel Ward, our resident GP, co-host of the Pharmacy Podcast. Now, Rachel, this is all about what the government wants the BMA to do. These ideas that will force every GP practice in England to make online booking open pretty much the whole time during working hours. And doctors aren't keen, are they?
Good afternoon. Yes, that is correct. And I think it's very interesting how Wes has kind of pulled this this argument, if you like. My question would be, why is the earning of a GP relevant when we are talking about safe practice? Is he saying that we earn so much money that we need to do more work? Potentially that is part of the argument, in which my response would be that we're the most productive people working in the NHS, looking at the number of patient contacts we have for our earnings. Or is he saying that we are being paid a significant amount that we need to, it's essentially danger money? Is that what his argument is? Because what the concern has been from GPs is that if you have a system where people can just request a medical opinion with no limit at all, it becomes unsafe because it becomes impossible to find out those urgent cases amongst the pile of non-urgent ones. So it's an interesting tack that he has taken here, and I would question it. I'm also thinking that I'm probably working in the wrong practice.
Okay. Yes. I mean, and let's just stick with doctors. There are concerns over, it does sound like quite a bad early flu season, and we're only, what is it, the 4th of November. The junior doctor strike starts on the 14th. And again, more pressure being heaped, I guess, on doctors to call off the strike action. The implication being, again, that so-called junior doctors, resident doctors, are paid enough already. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I was really interested to hear these figures that apparently were three times higher number of cases for this time of year, because I certainly haven't really felt that on the ground, I have to say. So, I mean, obviously these figures are correct. And last week, 247 people were admitted with flu. And we know that there is a spike amongst children. So really interesting to see that, because it doesn't feel particularly bad. But yes, you are right. This is another way which people are saying, you know, that junior doctors have a responsibility. We're going through a bad winter. But again, I mean, when have we gone into winter feeling prepared and having ample capacity in the NHS? Certainly not in the 20 years of my career has winter ever felt okay. So again, I think we need to kind of separate those arguments and really, you know, see what's going on. It is concerning that we are seeing more flu. And again, it's a good reason to encourage people to go out there, get their flu jab if they are eligible to do so.
Yeah, we often end up talking about vaccines, but you're right. Flu jabs, I think, would be helpful this winter, as every winter. Really interesting. University College London is going to provide the world's first dedicated centre for people who have young onset dementia. Now, I didn't know very much about young onset dementia. Surely it's very uncommon, Rachel.
It is relatively uncommon, yes. And I think the difficulty with early onset dementia, so this is people who were diagnosed less than 65 years old, is there are multiple different types of it. So if you look at each actual specific cause of young onset dementia, yes, a lot of them fall into the rare disease categories. You know, some that people may be familiar with are things like familial Alzheimer's, so where you get a genetic predisposition inherited. People will have come across Bruce Willis's disease, which is primary progressive aphasia. And there's also diseases such as frontotemporal dementia, which is the most common in that age group. But yes, it individually, they are relatively uncommon. But there are 70,000 people in Britain at the moment with young onset dementia. So it, you know, relatively looking at it like that, a huge number of people that could do with additional support and something that needs more research and intervention.
And are the symptoms broadly similar to the kind of things we might expect to see in people over 65?
It can be. So people can certainly present with problems with their memory, but people can also present with quite different symptoms, which is a reason why it often takes a while to make a diagnosis, and it can be difficult to make a diagnosis. So some people may present with a change in personality, for example. And, you know, obviously, when you are young, there are multiple other different diagnoses to consider. So you do hear of many examples, unfortunately, of people having a delay in their diagnosis. And this is another reason at this centre, which is being developed by UCL, they will do education around young onset dementia, you know, helping the medical profession to have a better understanding and make diagnosis more efficient as well.
Yes, I mean, it sounds really much needed, and congratulations to the people who are going to be involved with it. Rachel, thank you very much indeed. That's Dr. Rachel Ward, who's our programme GP and co-host of the Pharmacy Podcast. It's interesting that Rachel says herself she hasn't seen much evidence of flu on the go, but clearly people are getting it. Interestingly, it's the Japanese are reporting an epidemic of flu in schools. They've had to close schools because of it.
And that would be a country that informs what happens here, usually.
Definitely.
So we'd do well to take note, wouldn't we? Mm. I think Australia's the same, isn't it? They've had a difficult flu season already.
Yes, I think they have. It's spring in Australia, isn't it?
Let's not think about
that. How annoying.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
All of that takes us to 3 o'clock. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio. Coming up in the next hour, Rachel Reeves says we all have to do our bit to build up the country, so our tax rises definitely on the cards. We'll get the very latest from the Sunday Times' economics editor. Germany has been split by rows over conscription, only a year since the Conservatives proposed their own version. Could it play a part in our security here? Our big interview after 3:30 is with the historian and celebrity traitor's star, David Olusoga, and we'll also talk about HSBC offering mortgage seekers deals of up to 6.5 times their salary. It's not the 1980s. First, the news with Stuart Willey.
Fee, thank you. Good afternoon. The Chancellor has laid the groundwork for potential tax rises, warning of the challenges she faces to balance the country's books. In a speech, Rachel Reeves said her promise to meet fiscal rules is ironclad. That prompted a fall in government borrowing costs as well as the value of the pound. She set out her priorities as cutting NHS waiting lists, reducing national debt and reducing the cost of living.
If we are to build the future of Britain together, we will all have to contribute to that effort. Each of us must do our bit for the security of our country and the brightness of its future.
The Conservatives say her job will be untenable if she breaks Labour's manifesto pledge not to raise taxes. The Liberal Democrat Deputy Leader Daisy Cooper is also not impressed.
I think Rachel Reeves has really missed the mark. Households and small businesses are really, really struggling out there. They can't afford to pay any more tax, but this seems to be the only answer that Rachel Reeves has left.
A senior social media executive has told the Southport Inquiry it would be tyrannical overreach to remove a stabbing video watched by Axel Rudakubana on the morning of the attack. Giving evidence on behalf of X, formerly Twitter, Diana Romina Kanani Show said the company was anti-censorship. Jurors have been asked to acquit the woman accused of stalking the parents of Madeleine McCann. A barrister says the Polish national Julia van Delt is a rather sad and pathetic young woman who gained nothing from approaching the family. Former sub-postmaster Sir Alan Bates has settled his compensation claim with the government over the Horizon IT scandal. He's understood to be getting a seven-figure sum. Meanwhile, it's emerged the public inquiry into the affair will now not be reporting this year. Journalist Nick Wallace, author of The Great Post Office Scandal, told Times Radio it's down to the process of Maxwellization that gives those who are criticised an opportunity to respond.
The inquiry will not be sending out the letters, they're known as warning letters, to the individuals until January at the earliest. That therefore means that they have to be integrated, responded to, dealt with and incorporated into whatever Sir Wyn Williams, the chair of the inquiry, wants to say in his final report. And the estimate is that it's not going to be until at least 6 months after that.
Police are investigating whether opportunities were missed to catch Huntingdon trade suspect Anthony Williams, who's charged with multiple counts of attempted murder. He's been linked to a number of knife incidents in the 24 hours before the attack, including the stabbing of a 14-year-old boy in Peterborough. There are calls for more measures to crack down on knife crime, but the former Metropolitan Police officer Victor Elisa says many measures aren't workable.
So I've heard some conversations around, can we have knife arches, metal detectors at railway stations, and the practicalities of doing that are enormous.
And George W. Bush has paid tribute to his former Vice President Dick Cheney, who has died at the age of 84. Bush said he was grateful to have Mr. Cheney by his side for 8 years. For a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
We are here for whatever room in the house, actually. It's 4 minutes past three. It is Jane and Fee until 4 o'clock this afternoon. We are going to talk about mortgages because the landscape of the mortgage deal does appear to be changing. HSBC offering up to 6.5 times your salary, and some other banks are starting to do the same thing, although not that high, and also talking about lowering interest rates, particularly on fixed-term deals. So we'll do that at about a quarter to four. David Olesoga joins us after 3:30 to talk about his work, and we do talk about traitors. I asked him, just out of politeness at the beginning of that interview, how long I was allowed to ask him questions about his proper work before delving into traitors, and he said, just keep it right till the end, please. So I did.
So we don't know if he's won?
No, we said, no, we certainly don't know if he's won. No, don't try and ruin things for everybody, please. Well, we were told this morning, weren't we, by the Chancellor, it felt a little bit like a teacher telling us the topics that will be in the exam on November the 26th, but not the exact questions. And then she asked us to prepare for it. And I wonder how that's left you feeling. Are you happy to do the homework? She's left the door open to breaking Labour's manifesto promise on tax rises in the upcoming budget, saying that she'll make what she called necessary choices.
As I take my decisions on both tax and spend, I will do what is necessary to protect families from high inflation and interest rates, to protect our public services from a return to austerity, and to ensure that the economy that we hand down to future generations is secure, with debt under control. If we are to build the future of Britain together, we will all have to contribute to that effort. Each of us must do our bit.
Well, the Chancellor's unusually timed pre-budget speech pointed to global challenges over the past year and blamed previous governments for lower than expected productivity. But will the public accept that explanation if it means higher taxes for working people, to use the phrase of the moment? We're joined by David Smith, the Sunday Times' economics editor. David, what did you make of the speech this morning?
I think, as you say, this was a Chancellor who I think has probably known what she's going to do in the budget for some time. And in fact, I put a question to her a couple of weeks ago on that, and she sort of suggested that she knew what she was going to do. But she can't tell us, and things could change. But if I was a betting person, I would think that income tax is going to go up. Income tax rates are going to go up probably across the board. And I think the pill will be sweetened by the getting rid of the 5% VAT on energy bills, domestic energy bills. I don't know whether you remember, but when Gordon Brown was Chancellor and we were then in the EU, and the he wanted to reduce VAT on energy bills, but the most he could do was reduce it to 5%, because that was the minimum allowed for in the EU. Rachel Reeves is not constrained by that, obviously, so she could do that. But that would be a small offset to the expected income tax rise. So I think it was very interesting. It was, you know, it was a menu without prices, I suppose, is the way to describe it.
Absolutely. And when she was asked directly whether she stands by her previous promises not to raise income tax, national insurance or VAT, this was her response.
I will set out the individual policies at the budget on the 26th of November. That's not what today is about. Today is about setting the context for that budget. And your viewers can see the challenges that we face, but the challenges that are on a global nature. And they can also see the challenges in the long-term performance of our economy. And the Office of Budget Responsibility will set all that out. They've done the review of the supply side of the economy. That looks at the past, but they use the past to predict the future. And as Chancellor, I have to face the world as it is, not the world that I want it to be. And when challenges come our way, the only question is how to respond to them, not whether to respond or not.
It's interesting, isn't it, to choose this time to give us all this lecture, David. And I wonder, you know, when she says we're setting the context, how many people want the context to be set? I mean, there is an argument that you elect a government and the government goes and does government stuff and then it comes back and it tells you and you get on with your stuff. I mean, this is a it's a unique thing that she's done here. Will it work?
It is unusual. And, you know, I think it's true to say, as you're implying, that, you know, people don't talk about OBR, Office of Budget Responsibility, if they talk about it at all, productivity assumptions down at the dog and duck. You know, it's that's one for nerds like me, you know, so we think about that. I think the point at which this changed, I think, for Rachel Reeves was probably when she received those different productivity numbers from the OBR. The Treasury was certainly expecting a downgrade, but I don't think it was expecting a downgrade quite as large as the one that the OBR is going to give us. And I think until then, the hope was that they could get by with a lot of smaller tax increases. You know, things like, you know, we talked about income tax just now, and there are more ways of putting up income tax than just increasing rates. As you both know, you know, the freeze on income tax allowances and thresholds, which has been in place for the past 3 or 4 years, is a stealth tax. It's a way of putting up income tax because those allowances should normally rise in line with inflation. So we thought, you know, a few weeks ago that she might just extend that freeze for another couple of years at the end of the parliament, and that would have got a reasonable amount of money in. But I think it's the extent of the productivity downgrade that does it. And I think the game here for Rachel Reeves is essentially to say, well, you know, don't blame me for this. You know, she will be blamed, but she's trying to say that this is the product of a lot of changes that have happened to the economy since 2010 when the OBR was set up, which includes, you know, the fact that, you know, we haven't had the kind of economic growth we had before the financial crisis. Brexit contributed to the weakness of business investment and thus the slowdown in productivity growth. And then we had the two big shocks of the pandemic and the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So it's all those things taken together, you know, one thing after another, which has contributed to this. And I think that's what she's trying to do. But of course, you know, as you say, you know, people will not, you know, people blame the people in charge, the person in charge. They don't blame, you know, whoever was, you know, we had many chancellors, certainly at the end of the period of Conservative government. And they won't think about, you know, was this Rishi Sunak's fault? Was this Jeremy Hunt's fault? Was it the fault of people you've probably already forgotten were chancellors quite briefly?
Well, that's very rude about Philip Hammond, isn't it?
Well, I think it was quite nice not to mention Kwasi Kwarteng.
You weren't being kind. Other people would have gone straight there. But also, she does have to reassure the markets, doesn't she? And how much of what she said today was actually aimed at them?
I think a certain amount, and she will be relieved that there hasn't been a much of a market response to this. I mean, sterling is down a bit, but that's, I think, due to other factors. The cost of government borrowing has not moved on this. I think, and the city reaction is, what was all that about? We knew all this anyway, and so it was a political, political journalists were invited to the event. It was a political event. It was preparing the ground, pitch rolling. But I don't think there was anything in there to surprise the financial markets. They want to see the results of what she announces. And
they like her, don't they? When there was a suggestion that, maybe her position wasn't entirely safe. Wasn't it actually the markets that kind of saved her?
They did a bit. For reasons we don't fully yet know, and the Chancellor was in tears in the Commons Chamber. I think the fear was then the markets reacted badly to that, not necessarily because they don't think anybody else could do the job, but because they remember the kind of instability I was just alluding to when we had, virtually a different chancellor every week. And so I think they didn't want to return to that. So that's why they reacted badly to her appearing to be very upset in the Commons Chamber. But I also think that, this is, what will satisfy the markets? An income tax increase is solid. It's it's a statement that she says her fiscal rules are sacrosanct, and that if she's doing something as unpopular and manifesto breaking as putting up income tax, that suggests a tough approach to keeping the debt under control. But I think markets would also like to see something on the spending side. I mean, if she really wanted to make them happy and make every pensioner and prospective pensioner in the country unhappy, she would say, well, we've got to review the triple lock. It can't survive for very long. But we have to see what happens on the spending side. I mean, I think the thing that would have made the financial markets slightly blanch was the big commitment again to the NHS, because the NHS is the cuckoo in the spending nest, which takes up a lot of the resources. And committing again to that at the same time as committing to putting up taxes suggests that we're going down the same old road again that we've been on for some years.
And tell us about that same old road, David, because, you have a long view across our economy. Is there a bit missing? Is there an exciting, daring new solution to the problems that so many G7 nations face at the moment in terms of balancing their books? Is there a new place to go?
Yeah, well, I think we're all facing, to a greater or lesser extent, the same problems of aging populations and slow growth. And because of slow growth, voters being impatient and with any government, really, it's I was reading the former Tory chief whip's diaries recently, and the title of those is Ungovernable. And in some ways, when you have a period of slow growth, things are very difficult. I think we're all, looking, there are two views about AI, artificial intelligence. One is that it's a massive bubble waiting to burst. The other is it's the cavalry that's going to come over the hill and rescue this weak productivity and give us better times ahead. And I think I would lean more towards the second view than the first. And of course, we would hope that would also enable us to deliver public services more cheaply than we can now. So, if AI can do a fraction of what its champions say it could do, I think that is the thing which might make a difference in the future. Technology can help in this regard, and I would hope that the AI technology can do that in the future. But otherwise, I don't think we want to be here in a year's time reflecting on another speech by the Chancellor, if it is indeed this Chancellor telling us how bad things are and she's got to come back for more.
Yeah, let's not make that date then, David. Thank you. I'm going to lean with you into your positivity, because I think we all need some of that at the moment. That is David Smith, the Sunday Times' economics editor.
I like the positivity
about
AI,
that very much.
Particular. Let's
stick with David.
Let's remember that and, yes, embrace it fondly. Now, next on Times Radio, Germany is thinking about bringing back a sort of conscription. They certainly need more young people in their armed forces. The young people in Germany, not that keen, surprise, surprise. next, we're going to ask whether it really could return here. We'll talk to a military man and to the current president of the National Union of Students. That's next. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wickes, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
We're going to be talking to Ben Cohen, the founder of Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream, about why he likes to mix dairy produce and politics. And speaking of American politics, we'll be bringing you the results live of the New York mayoral election, which has got everyone in America talking.
We'll also look ahead to Prime Minister's questions in this country, and we'll be joined by Edwina Curry and Giles Curran from Nine.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
Making your home more energy efficient has many benefits, both for the environment and your personal finances. Aaron Friedrich lives in Surrey. His house was designed to be more eco-friendly, and having a smart meter helps him manage his energy use.
I have definitely learned a lot about how to use the house in a more efficient way. You can make as many changes as you think are going to help, but unless it's measurable in numbers and digits every day, you're not going to know what changes and improvements you're making. It's had a huge effect on household bills. It's definitely brought them under control. It wasn't expensive at all. It was provided by my energy provider. You can see how much energy you're using, see the practices being translated into hard numbers. If I was to give advice to anyone, I'd say get a smart meter. You can always do better. No matter how much you think you've made changes, how much your house is insulated against the climate, or it uses low energy light bulbs, you can always make improvements.
To find out more, search Get a Smart Meter. Eligibility may vary.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms. Ready to start your next home project? This autumn at Wickes, there are great kitchen and bathroom offers available. Explore the ranges at wickes.co.uk or visit the showroom in your local Wickes store.
Young people in Germany are pushing back against plans for conscription. Now, the plans would see all young men in Germany undergo mandatory screening for national service by the middle of 2027, although we need to make it clear that service itself will remain voluntary in Germany. Since Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022, the conversation around conscription has, of course, re-emerged across Europe in many different forms. Here in the UK, it's only a year since the former Tory Prime Minister Rishi Sunak included a national service scheme for 18-year-olds in his election campaign. Can you remember that? Seems a lifetime ago, doesn't it? Let's talk about this issue now with Amira Campbell, president of the National Union of Students, about why many young people might not be all that keen on the notion of national service. First, though, we'll have a word with Colonel Simon Diggins, former British Army officer and defence analyst. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
Can you tell me a little bit about what you think broadly about the very notion of national service?
I think national service only makes sense if the nation actually believes in it. And so I think one of the things that has to happen is that any conversation about what form the national service is going to take has got to be preceded by a much wider conversation about explaining why it's necessary. Now, what the Germans have been saying is that because of the nature of the threat which they face, they feel some form of conscription needs to come back. Our problem, I suspect, is geographical distance may suggest that may not be necessary. I happen to believe that some form of national service may be appropriate, but I'd like to see a wide conversation where we talk to people, but particularly to young people, and explain why some form of national service, and for me, that would be a mixture potentially of military service and or some kind of civilian service, might be appropriate.
Right. Now, I'm assuming because you've served in the British Army, you will not ever have worked with conscripts. Is that the case?
No, ironically, firstly, I'm old enough to have joined when the last of the conscripts then became regulars were still around, so they could explain to me what national service was.
Right.
And of course, all my European colleagues, most of them were conscript armies, so I had quite a good understanding of what they did and why they did it. The interesting thing about conscription is it's got two roles. The first role is about providing a resource. Additional personnel for service that might not be available through a voluntary system. But there's a much wider role, which actually goes right back to the beginnings of modern conscription, which is the French army, the Revolutionary Wars, which is this idea of a nation in arms. And it was a kind of societal binding exercise, much as anything else. And it was very much the argument of the Germans at the time, not only they needed additional people to support their armed forces, faced as they were with the German border and the Soviet threat, but they also thought it was important with all the traumas of World War II behind them, that they had a means of bringing people together as a nation, so the nation was not so divided. And I think both aspects, when we look at the issue, are very important.
But could you tell me, from your perspective, whether or not it was obvious who had been conscripted and who had elected to be there?
Sometimes. I mean, I think there was quite a lot of general acceptance of it. I mean, there were exceptions to this, and I'm not going to name the countries, but there was a particular country who at the time was regarded somewhat in a sort of joking fashion because they'd made significant compromises, shall we say, on hair length. And so you saw people sort of going into training exercises with wearing hair nets, which reduced a certain amount of kind of wry humour at the time.
Are we allowed to make an education guess as to which nation that might be, or would that...
You're welcome to. I know exactly. The, go for it. Go on. You tell me.
Was it Italy?
No. You've got to come further north. Come further north. Just across the North Sea.
North Sea from Italy. Fee, help me out.
No, you're on your own here.
Oh, no. Okay. Let's not go there.
It was the Dutch, so there you go.
The Dutch.
But I mean, they also had first class of naval officers and some very good army officers as well, and they are as military as they need to be, which is a bit like us. Bear in mind our tradition is also that Henry V, warriors for the working day. Even if people like myself are regular officers, we don't have that kind of militaristic tradition inside us. And that was one of the reasons why the Germans had conscription, in a sense, was to have a military that was effective as a military, but was not also imbued with that kind of Prussian militaristic tradition. And I think that's also something we would need to be very careful of if we brought some kind of national service into ourselves. We're not producing some kind of elite stormtrooping force. We're actually trying to provide proper defence. As people like the Finns, the Danes, the Estonians, Latvians, Lithuanians, and even the Poles are now starting to do, faced with the threat they can now see very clearly on their doorsteps.
Thank you. I hope to come back to you if we have the time. That's Colonel Simon Diggins. Let's bring in Amira Campbell, President of NUS UK. Amira Campbell, what do you think about this? I mean, your members in NUS UK, would they be keen on the concept of some sort of national service?
I think it'll be really challenging. I mean, what we've seen, and I actually think there was some polling in 2023 that YouGov did that showed that only 10% of young people aged between 18 and 24 were even supportive of any sort of year-long national conscription. So it's clearly not a popular idea among multiple young people. We've also got the challenge of young people feeling not served and supported right now politically. I mean, we've seen some really promising things, such as Votes at 16, which is absolutely massive for youth voice right now.
Yeah.
But I think we need to see some real incredible progress in the material conditions of young people in this country to show that this country is serving them too.
I take your point. I mean, I think many young people would say, why would I lay down my life for a country that doesn't offer me the opportunity, even the distant dream of owning my own place to live?
I think you've hit, that's bang on, right? I mean, we're currently in a place where people can barely afford their rent right now, where so many young people struggle to pursue the academic or the educational ventures that they want to without going into thousands and thousands of pounds of debt. You've got people that cannot access the transport costs because transport costs are so high and it's so difficult in that sense. And there's just this recurring feeling amongst so many young people that they are not being prioritised by the current government or by the previous government. There are opportunities for us to tackle and change that. And I think actually what was being said about that join up between what young people are asking for and then what the state asks of young people really needs to come together.
Yeah.
And I think often behind some of these proposals, there are sort of two things that are the key backdrop. There's a real genuine fear, right, around what's happening, the geopolitical climate that we're existing in, the increasing levels of conflict, of war, of death, like that. There's a real fear there and a need for us to tackle and be able to come up against that. But then also some of it is informed by a sort of contempt sometimes against young people. Often assuming that young people aren't major contributors, aren't giving up their time, aren't volunteering. But all of the stats tell us that that's not true. You know, we see young people contributing and volunteering the most of any people. We saw young people step up to the plate when they needed to, when we had the COVID pandemic.
Sure.
And we saw loads and loads of medical students who hadn't even finished their degrees step up, take to the front lines and save lives.
I mean, you're absolutely right. Very, very commendable stuff. Can I just put a point to you that one of the listeners has made, actually, about the idea that conscription and that we were talking in particular about these plans for a sort of conscription in Germany, it would only apply to young men. Now, in Britain, I suspect that you're a feminist. I'm sure you are, Amira. Certainly, we'd count ourselves as feminists in the room here. You can't do that anymore, can you? Women would have to be included in some sort of conscription, should we ever have it in the UK. What do you think?
I mean, fundamentally, I think we shouldn't be looking towards a place where we're having to take multiple young people, men, women, non-binary, any identity into a place of having to be conscripted in the first place. And I also think what we should be prioritizing is youth choice, right? At the end of the day, what we should be saying is that multiple people have a choice to take the path that they want to. And I think a massive part of feminism and equality is actually about having that choice, about being able to decide your own future and decide your own pathways. So I'm not quite sure that's quite the feminist cause.
Thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it. That's Amira Campbell, president of NUS UK. Well, what do you think about that, Simon? And of course, let's just focus on the idea that I put to Amira, that young people don't feel that Britain's offering them a fat lot at the moment. So why on earth would they want to, frankly, die on the battlefield for the country?
And I totally agree with Amira. I mean, I think she put it extremely well. I mean, if you're going to, as a country, ask young people, as you say, to potentially die on a battlefield, you've got to make sure that the offer for young people is good. And I despair, and I mean, I'm a father of four children, I despair at some of the issues and challenges that they are going to be are facing now, my older ones and my younger ones will face in the future. So I'm absolutely with Amira on that. You know, in terms of housing, education, student debt, all those issues, I think if we're going to ask our young people to do more for the country, and I think we may have to do so, then we must work much, much harder to make sure that their interests are looked after, because they are our future, not just in terms of providing us the resilience that we might need for any threats we face, but for the future after that as well. Her points are very strongly made and I totally support them.
Really interesting. Thank you very much indeed, Colonel Simon Diggins, former British Army Colonel and Defence Analyst. And you also heard from Amira Campbell, the President of NUS UK. And Amira, it's true, isn't it, that politicians are all over the pensioners, because pensioners go out and vote. And we do know that a lot of young people don't bother voting, and they don't bother voting because they're disillusioned. And I understand that too. But actually, the more they vote, the more attention politicians will pay to them.
Well, if you're going to lower the age of voting as well,
take advantage of it.
Take advantage of it.
Get out there.
And really put your point of view across vociferously, because that will be a game changer in certain constituencies as well. So, yes, it might change the nature of debate. If conscription had been around when you were a young person, so let's just say it was national service, you had to do a year, there wasn't necessarily anything that was going to come your way afterwards, you weren't entering into some kind of a covenant with the armed forces, would you have done that very willingly? Because you are quite a dutiful citizen. You're in the Girl Guides till you're about
25.
Thank you. So would you have thought, yes, actually, this is going to be something I should do and I will do it happily?
If I'm really honest, I think I might have preferred the community. I would happily have done community service. And I don't actually think there's anything wrong with that as a concept. I think it would be lovely if young people, let's say when you're 18, in that year between school and uni or whatever it is, if that's the path you choose to take. I'm not sure that I'd go with the idea of community service being no bad thing.
Mm.
But I'm not sure about the military element myself. What about you?
Well, we are a forces family. So my father was in the army, and his father before him, and his father before him, and his brother. And I suspect that that just makes for a slightly different, you know, round the kitchen table conversation. And I think actually it would have been a marked difference between me and my friends that I would have been more willing to do something like that and felt comfortable doing it, because it's often just what you know, isn't it, than my friends who would have absolutely balked at it.
Yeah. Should we bring in Martin? He's got quite a firm attitude.
I don't think I should say no to this.
Conscription should be compulsory, but only for the unemployed. says Martin sympathetically. Right, thank you very much. Now, coming up, we'll talk about new mortgage plans from HSBC. And we're joined by the most famous historian in the land, I would venture to suggest, David Olusoga. First, we'll check on the headlines. Here is Stuart Willey.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Jane, thank you. Good afternoon. Rachel Reeves has blamed poor productivity, rising national debt and what she calls a rushed and ill-conceived Brexit as she prepares for possible manifesto-breaking tax rises. The Chancellor has taken the unusual step of a pre-budget speech in Downing Street where government debt was one of her key focuses. The Times' economics correspondent Jack Barnett has been watching market reaction.
Because the Chancellor is now facing up to the fiscal reality and saying, you know, we probably do need to break the manifesto pledge and go quite hard on taxes. There's been a little bit of talk about some spending restraint as well. And I think the markets have taken that well in the bond markets. That's pushed down the UK's borrowing costs. That in then turn also pushes down sterling as well because it makes UK assets a little bit less attractive.
Train company LNER says it's extremely proud of the rail worker who's still in a critical condition after Saturday's mass stabbing on a train. He's been named as Samir Zitouni. The 48-year-old was left fighting for his life after trying to protect passengers during the incident. A train which derailed when it struck a landslide in Cumbria yesterday morning has now been removed after Network Rail engineers worked through the night. And 1 in 10 children in the first year of primary school in England is obese. Data from the National Child Measurement Programme also found more than a fifth of Year 6 pupils are severely overweight. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Growing a business takes a powerful team. People who think big, raise the bar, and smash expectations. People who are feeling at their best, not worried and waiting for healthcare. If you're ready to take your business to the next level, you need a team that's ready to deliver. Bupa helps your people to get health worries seen and sorted with fast access to expert advice, including GPs and physios. Your team will have fast help for muscle, bone, and joint problems, plus mental health services and cancer cover as standard, so they're ready for whatever life throws at them, at home and at work. Take your business further by building a happier, healthier and more motivated team. And as prevention is better than cure, your team will have access to our digital wellbeing services, including 1,500 gym classes, mindfulness programmes and expert content. That's better for your team and better for your business. Get ready to power your growth with small business health insurance that powers your people. Let's get growing. Search Bupa Small Business.
Ever wondered what power is? Power is transforming the sun into your own energy source. Power is getting energy companies to pay you. Power is enjoying your morning coffee, knowing you created the energy to make it. Well, you and the colossal ball of fire in the sky. Because with solar panels from Hive, the sun works for you. Hive, know your power. May not cover all electricity usage, roof and weather dependent. Paid for surplus requires eligible SET tariff.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. The experts in bathroom design and installation. Transform your bathroom. Book a free home visit and measure, and then let the Wix design experts help you choose from thousands of products. Book a free bathroom design appointment at wix.co.uk.
4:25, and David Olusoga awaits. You can hear from him in a couple of minutes' time here on Times Radio. HSBC will lend home buyers up to 6.5 times their salary for their mortgages. It is the highest offer of any high street lender. It is the first bank to offer more than 6 times a buyer's salary since, well, you know when, the financial crisis back in 2008. Let's talk to financial expert Holly Mead. How do these mortgages work, Holly?
I mean, the mortgage works like any other mortgage in that you put down a deposit and you borrow more money than you ever wanted to borrow in your life.
It's great. And you buy a mansion.
And you, well, it depends, doesn't it, where you are in the capital, where you are in the world. If you're in the capital, you probably buy a small shoebox. I think this starts a lot of alarm bells ringing for people because we think of overreaching and overextended borrowers, and it starts to bring back visions of the financial crisis and that film The Big Short.
Yes.
I think what's really important to say about this is that banks are loosening the purse strings, but they are being encouraged to by the financial regulator, because the fact is that the average house price in the UK is now almost 8 times the average salary. Yes. So saving a deposit for that for most people is just a colossal task.
And there is the recognition. Again, Holly, just so that we've got this. So the average house price is, did you say 8 times?
It's about 7.7.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, that is extraordinary, isn't it?
It is. And also, if you're someone who's renting, so you're spending £1,300-1,400 a month on rent, how are you supposed to raise a deposit for that? Yeah. So banks are being told by the FCA to be more innovative. And you know, they've already been told to loosen those stress tests when you're assessed for a mortgage affordability. So it used to be that, for example, you take a mortgage out at 4%, but the bank wants to check your finances and check you could handle it if rates suddenly shot up by to 8%. There's kind of been recognition that that's a really extreme test for anyone, and it doesn't need to be that strict. So we're starting to see more banks think about what they can do. And the important thing with this one to note is you have to hit some pretty tough criteria. Yes. To get it.
What you need, an annual income of what?
You either need a salary of £100,000, or you need to have £100,000 with HSBC in savings or investment. So that is no small feat. Mm. You also need at least a 10% deposit. So this isn't going back to the 100% or self-cert mortgage days. And the other thing I think that gets overlooked a lot is that it's easy to look at a 6.5 times earnings borrowing situation on a case-by-case basis, but overall, banks, their entire mortgage books, they're only allowed to lend 15% of their total lending above 4.5 times earnings. So this is going to be a teeny, teeny, tiny fraction of HSBC's overall lending. It's going to be for special cases where the bank is confident that someone has the affordability to meet those repayments. And frankly, if they've got £100,000 sitting in savings with the bank, it really doesn't have to worry about them not making their mortgage repayment each month, I would say.
No, I mean, it'll be interesting to see how many other banks do something similar in the near future.
So Nationwide already offers up to 6.5 times, and that's through it's called a helping hand mortgage scheme, which is for a particular type of first-time buyer. And then we saw Halifax go up to 5.5 times earning, but it wants people to have a 15% deposit. And I think we've spoken about this before. This is an earnings base, but there are a couple of banks now that will lend you up to 100% of a mortgage, but you do have to really prove that you can afford that. And there are sometimes you might need a guarantor or something. Yeah. Or a track record of paying rent for 2 years to show that you aren't just sort of blindly shooting in the dark over this. So I don't think we are returning to 2008 situations. I think there is just kind of a recognition of the plight of how hard it is to buy a home in this country.
Thank you. That's Holly Mead, financial expert.
You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio. In a couple of moments' time, we're going to hear from the historian David Olusoga on his tour and his time in the Celebrity Traitor Spotlights. We are with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Hugo Rifkind on Times Radio with Bupa Small Business Health Insurance. When it comes to must-listen mid-morning radio, we've got you covered. There's world-class journalism to broaden your mind, in-depth discussion that gets right to the heart of the issues, and entertaining conversation guaranteed to tickle your funny bone.
And it can be quite humorous.
Hugo Rifkind, tomorrow morning from 10 on Times Radio with Bupa Small Business Health Insurance. Let's get growing.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Oh, we can all be a bit forgetful from time to time, and Mum was no exception. Always losing her glasses and then not being able to find them again. It's a good job they were 2 for 1 at the opticians.
At the last count, I think she had 12 pairs.
Yeah, but there came a point when we noticed that it was more than just being a bit forgetful. And that's when we knew that Mum was going to need someone to give her some extra help around the house.
So that's where we got Claire in to help. She's Mum's care professional from Home Instead. She's wonderful and comes to the house most days. Home Instead are amazing. It really is the best quality care in your own home. And it's really reassuring to know that Mum's being looked after by someone as patient and kind as Claire.
Yeah, and as well as all the day-to-day stuff that Claire does, she also helps Mum with her favourite thing in the world,
baking. Mum's chocolate cake was always the talk of the town, and it turns out that with Claire's help, it still is.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
When they say, don't get me anything, you know what they really mean. Give the birthday gift they really want from Hotel Chocolat. Cakes transformed into chocolate for those who choose dessert over a starter. Or, if they like it nutty, a box bursting with pralines and epically crunchy whole nut chocolates. Add a gift bag and a complimentary gift sleeve and make it a birthday moment. Find the gift you know they'll love in store or online at Hotel Chocolat.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Now, David Olusoga has a new legion of fans through his appearance on The Traitors, where he's proving to be a probing questioner, thoughtful observer, and like the rest of the faithfuls, absolutely rubbish at playing the game. He remains totally top of his game in the real world, though, where he will shortly be bringing us a series called Empire on the TV and a brand new talk called History's Missing Chapters, all about the people that history has left behind and what that void does to our true understanding of what's gone before and therefore where we are now. As a professor of public history, he takes his work seriously and has received an OBE for services to history and public understanding. And now he gets to call out Alan Carr and marvel at Jonathan Ross's huge tweed cape and matching ego. We started with the real work, though, and a look ahead to next year's touring talk, which features some quite shocking props on stage.
Yeah, I'm going all around the country with a big bunch of guns, historic firearms, from a flintlock musket from the early 18th century all the way up to a Tommy gun and a Maxim machine gun. And to have the guns on stage is because what I want to argue in this tour is that guns are a real part of our social history. They're not just military history. They're part of what changed the world. They're part of the lives of our ancestors. And of course, we in Britain, because we have proper, sensible gun laws, unlike some countries, we don't come into contact with guns. So it is about trying to understand these objects as part of social history rather than military history.
How did you feel the first time that you held a gun that you must know had at some point been fired at another human being and probably taken that life?
Well, that's what I found really disturbing about guns. Now, some historians, and I've written books about the First World War, some historians collect guns and they have them in their homes, and I'm not judging anyone. I'm too squeamish for that. I've never collected guns. I don't like guns. I'm not comfortable around them. And in some ways, I think that's a kind of normal attitude. But however, at the same time, I think if we're honest with ourselves, we're fascinated by them because they're a bit mysterious to us in Britain, because they're not part of our lives. We don't live in a society awash with guns the way many people around the world do. So there is something repellent, but also something magnetic about guns. And in some ways, that's what makes them so interesting. These are terrible objects, but just look at go to the cinema, look at the movies that we watch. You can see that guns are also something that we are really have a dark glamour.
Yeah. And you're so right to kind of shock people with the reality of guns, because in this country, we do now largely see guns just in fiction, don't we? Where there is very, very rarely any realistic portrayal of the damage that that weapon might do. I mean, it's quite absurd when you pause to think about it for longer than a nanosecond.
It is, and our culture glamorizes guns, and in some ways, you know, they are glamorous objects, and I mean, they shouldn't be, but there's no point pretending that they're not. So our culture does glamorize them and wants to brush to the margins what they do, and I try in this tour, without getting too graphic, to remind us of that, but also to talk about how these machines have changed the world, how they had unintended consequences, how they had strange histories, how very often what they meant, their significance, was not fully understood at the time. The great revolutionary guns, and the most important here is the Maxim machine gun, the first real machine gun. There's a 30-year lag between that gun being invented and people understanding that it absolutely changed the world. Mm.
You are an extremely busy man. You've got another tour. Am I right in saying History's Missing Chapters should also focus our attention?
Yeah, I'm also doing a tour, which is it's a lecture and essay I wrote earlier this year, which is about how certain and how and why certain aspects of our past get written out. And it's an appeal for us to build an inclusive history. And I mean, that's all kind of sounds, you know, lovely and lefty, but I mean, I really mean it in all sorts of ways. I mean, one of the stories I talk about is how I didn't understand, despite having done GCSE and then A-level history, I didn't understand Britain's relationship with Ireland until I had Irish friends, which was for the first time at university. I wasn't really studying Ireland at university, but what I realised was I knew almost nothing. I'd done a tiny bit to get through, pass the exams and get to do history at a British university. But that long relationship between Island of Britain and the island of Ireland, I really didn't understand it. And so we can't really have an inclusive history unless we understand, never mind the history of the empire, the history of the four nations that make up Britain and Ireland.
And how do you think that we will ever be able to really rectify that? Because I think you're absolutely right, for such an extraordinary, difficult history to have such close proximity to us in terms of time, in terms of politics, in terms of geography, but to be so largely ignored. I mean, the people who've wanted to be airbrushed from history have claimed quite a victory there, haven't they?
I think in all sorts of ways, our historical imagination has been quite limited. It's been quite channeled. I don't think curriculum very often have helped. I'm not sure that the stories that have been promoted by popular history, by historians writing books, have always been as inclusive as they could. But that really has changed in the past, maybe 50 years. There is an incredible appetite for history at the moment. You just need to look at the number of history tours and lectures, the number of history festivals, the history podcasts, as well as documentaries, and the number of books being published. I mean, this is a country with a real passion for history. And what I'm detecting, and I've been doing this a long time, is a growing appetite for more history, broader history, more inclusive history. We want to know the stories of our ancestors who were maids and servants. We want to understand the wars that this country went through, from what it was like to be a soldier, not just what it was like to be a general. We want a broader, more international, more inclusive version of our history. And that appetite for the past just never ceases to kind of humble me. I'm amazed by how much people love engaging with the past. You know, a great example, if I may, is the National Trust. I mean, it's 5.6-7 million members. That's the biggest membership organization in Britain. And it's a history and heritage organization.
Some of it must surely be about our own sense of individualism, because now we have social media. I know that there's a whole wealth of evidence that says it's rubbish, but actually what it has done, David, is to give us each a feeling that our voice can be heard. So when you start to consider that in your own life, would you agree that you look back to history and you actually do want to know more about individual lives? Is that playing a big part, do you think?
Well, I think the internet's really critical here, because for all of its flaws and the things we absolutely should be worried about particularly social media and the algorithms, the other thing that the internet has done is it's made millions of people into historians. One of the biggest activity online is genealogy. People used to have to hire historians to help them do that research, or they felt intimidated because they didn't want to go into archives. There are now platforms and there are research tools where, I mean, literally millions of people are doing that kind of magical thing when you click on a document and you see your ancestor's signature on a document, or you see the face of somebody who lived and died before your birth, who you're related to. And millions of people are engaged in that kind of magical connection with their history. And I think history can never go back to just being about great men, when so many of us, you know, we really want to know, what was that like for our great-grandparents? Or what happened in the house that we live in today? How was that affected by this event or that tragedy?
Are you consulted at all about what the history curriculum should be and could be in schools?
I've had some conversations with a few exam boards, but the thing I'm much more interested in doing is trying to put tools in the hands of teachers to be useful. I write history. The most useful thing I can do, the most useful place I can be, is here at my desk writing books. I've written books for children. I've written lesson plans with my older sister, Yinka, who is an academic in education. And I'm committed to sort of trying to make stuff available for teachers rather than tell them that they're doing it wrong, which they get a lot of, not just from historians, but from everybody.
Yeah. The monarchy has played such a huge part in the history of these Isles, David. Deference has been almost unwavering by comparison to other countries and cultures who've kicked out the monarchies. And I wonder where you think we are now, because undoubtedly what has happened over the last week or so with the stripping of the titles of Prince and HRH for Andrew have marked a real historical change, haven't they?
I think they have. I don't think we'll understand it for a few years, the level of significance of it. I'm always cautious about sort of predicting the decline of the British monarchy because it seems to survive every historical age and every crisis that's thrown at it. But this has not been a good week, and it isn't a good look. And you know, I've always been open that I'm a Republican in the British sense, not the American sense, I should stress. And that it is a, I think, an antiquated form of institution. But it is what we have. And because it is what we have, and because our king is our head of state, I want it to succeed. So, you know, there's a certain amount of sadness watching what's happened. I think what's happened is entirely appropriate. And I think few people would argue with that. But it does seem that this is a very specific moment of crisis. And I think with the passing of the Queen, I think a lot of us suspected that crisis was on its way. She was an incredible figure of solidity and continuity. And that her absence, I think, has been felt more greatly this week than any week since her passing. It was always going to be difficult, and I think it is proving difficult for the monarchy to adjust to the passing of the longest living monarch in our history.
Do you think her reputation suffers at all, David? Because Prince Andrew now, Mountbatten, Windsor, it'll take all of us quite a long time to stop saying it.
I can't quite work out what it is yet.
Yeah, I think it needs that.
Mountbatten, Windsor. It's been changing over the past week. It's been evolving.
Yes, it still remains a bit of a mouthful. But anyway, Andrew was said to be her favourite son. I mean, she undoubtedly helped him out enormously in terms of where he lived and how he lived. And I know that she is said to have wanted to censure him after the Newsnight interview. But actually, don't we come to realise that everybody within that family must have really been able to see Andrew in the light that we see him in now for a very long time?
I think it is sad that it has taken the emergence of all of this evidence for the institution, you know, we call it the palace, but it is a group of people and their advisors to act. I think it would have been far better if this had been done many years ago. And this is something that the royal family is going to have to reckon with. But in some ways, to go back to my earlier point, the royal family have been through so many crises. And it is a sort of braver historian than myself who would sort of predict the end of an institution that seems to weather every storm. This is entirely, in my view, appropriate. I think it would have been far better, as I say, if it had happened earlier. But the monarchy seems to be able to survive. The question is, are the attitudes of younger people that seem to be quite profoundly different on their than their parents and their grandparents on this institution, is that longer term risk in some ways more significant than this short term, you know, quite appalling crisis?
Sure. And presumably all of this plays into what you are telling us in History's Missing Chapters, that actually our obsession with some people at the top in terms of royal households and people who find themselves in leadership positions obscures the really interesting and valuable lives of so many other people.
I think so. And there is a big shift which has been taking place over many decades away from history just being the stories of great men, this Victorian Thomas Carlyle idea that really history was a series of biographies of great men. And that is not to say that significant figures don't have this colossal impact. I think the impact of Donald Trump will be something people will be talking about for centuries. But I think we are drawn as a people increasingly to a form of history that is more expansive, more inclusive, more about us and the lives that people like us lived through rather than what happens in palaces and parliaments. Mm.
We've done extremely well, David, because we have been talking now for a good almost 15 minutes and we haven't talked about traitors, but our audience would really not forgive me if I didn't ask you something about traitors.
Okay.
I mean, it's just such a monumental hit, isn't it? You can't tell us anything about what's going to happen across the course of this week.
That's right.
But tell us about your experience in there. It looks incredibly intense, is it?
Well, I think one of the strange things, obviously, programs are edited. I mean, the drama is real, but the drama is accentuated by editing. I mean, it was interesting that one thing that I think I hope comes across is how well we all got on together. I mean, round tables are built to be stressful. I mean, it is a stressful thing. But for the most part, I mean, out on those missions, we bonded every day. I love being there because I love being with those, you know, those 18 remarkable people. And I think one of the reasons, I mean, there's many reasons why we were terrible, particularly myself at this game, was I think it was largely because every day we went out, we did something amazing together, something totally out of normal life. And we bonded and we sort of came back and then we had to sort of banish one of ourselves. And it was the opposite, that what we had to do in the evening was so out of step with this kind of lovely communal experience of the rest of the day. So certainly the round tables can be stressful, but for the most part, it was joyous.
Mm. What about the egos, David? I mean, there were some whoppers in that castle.
You know, I didn't feel that so much. I found so many people so funny. My big memory is just of laughing the whole time. I mean, it's incredibly funny, amusing, entertaining people. I mainly remember giggling as well as kind of things like pushing a Trojan horse up a hill. It was hysterically funny. And obviously the round tables are stressful. They're these dramatic events, but it was also incredibly lighthearted and funny and silly.
The breakfast, David. Have you all had a decent breakfast before you go into the breakfast? Because nobody really seemed to do any eating of the breakfast and you had a very busy day ahead.
I think we're too busy being shocked by who has or who hasn't walked through the breakfast door to sort of focus on the croissants very much. There's too much drama in those morning breakfasts for the croissants to get top billing.
Right. And I've always wondered why there's just so much floral display on that table. What's going on with that?
It looks lovely there, doesn't it?
I mean, it looks lovely, but I mean, nobody...
It's like a wedding setting every morning.
Well, exactly. Nobody has that on their breakfast table. I didn't think that we were going to go there, but then we did. I think the foliage is hiding something suspicious. Yeah. I don't know what it is.
No wonder I'm not... I mean, I would actually be perfectly well able to focus on the croissant. I see one in front of me. Generally speaking, I want to eat it.
Well, I know. And I don't think they're being offered any hot goods at all, which would be very disappointing. I mean, it's a castle. At least a little bit of haggis and some black pudding.
Kedgeree.
Come on. Right, a few deviled eggs on display. David Olusoga, so you can catch History's Missing Chapters. That is the talk and tour he's doing at the moment. And then the one all about guns starts next year. He is touring around the country with that. He is a thoughtful man. It is always good to catch up with him. And I think his points about where we are in time with regards to the massive change in deference that we might have experienced to do with the demise of Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor is definitely worth thinking about. We are too close to it at the moment, I think, to fully understand what's gone on here.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think he's right too. I think we've lived through some quite important times almost without realising it. But then that's always what happens with history. It just happens. You don't realise you're living through it, do you? Shall I stop soon?
No, you carry on.
You carry on, Jane, yes, okay. I'm not going to carry on because everyone, even me, wants me to stop. We've got some cracking guests, as ever, throughout the rest of the course of this week here on Times Radio. Who do we want to thank today? Only producer Felix Forbes and our indefatigable technical operator, Ryan Boyden. He just keeps twiddling those knobs and keeping us on the road, doesn't he?
Do you want to just give the listeners a little bit more of a tease about who's coming up? You've done an interview with Petula Clark.
I have done an interview with Petula Clark. Do you know what? She was lovely. She's 93.
Amazing.
And she's got some cracking stories to tell. I think that you'll be able to hear that next week.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, V. Thank you, Jane. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar. This is Times Radio Drive, and here are the headlines. The pound has fallen to its lowest level in months, and government borrowing costs have dropped after the Chancellor used a speech at Downing Street to pave the way for tax rises. And the Times Defence Editor has told MPs the Afghan data leak super injunction left democracy in the deep freeze. And coming up, Rachel Reeves has laid the ground for another tough budget in a few weeks' time, telling voters each of us must do our bit to help the nation's finances. I know it comes as a surprise, but it does show the enormous tension across society, government and Labour's backbenches between the economic reality and the political reality. We're going to explore it with people who've been in the Treasury, talking to our political editor, Anna Mihailova, and the Confederation of British Industry. And we're going to be looking at the torrent of abuse facing shop workers spending your gap year in the military, and why Italian, they keep losing their keys.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Stuart Woolley.
John, thank you. Good afternoon. The pound has fallen to its lowest level in months, and government borrowing costs have dropped after the Chancellor used a speech at Downing Street to pave the way for tax rises. Rachel Reeves told voters each of us must do our bit, promising to stick to fiscal rules. Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch called her words a masterclass in managed decline. Economist Liam Halligan says the fiscal rules should be more flexible.
She needed to reassure financial markets that she was serious about getting spending under control. And yet ideologically and politically, she's trying to fix the budget off the back of higher taxation. That higher taxation, we're already at a 70-year record tax burden, will simply lower growth and unfortunately weaken the public finances further.
Victims of child sexual abuse unjustly convicted of prostitution are to have their criminal records wiped under changes to the law. A pardon scheme included in the Crime and Policing Bill will remove historic offences of loitering and soliciting prostitution as children where victims were under duress. It's one of 12 recommendations Baroness Louise Casey made in her review of grooming gangs. Jurors have been asked to acquit the woman accused of stalking the parents of Madeleine McCann. A barrister says Polish national Julia van Delt is a rather sad and pathetic young woman who gained nothing from approaching the family. The Times' defence editor has told MPs the Afghan data leak super injunction has left democracy in the deep freeze. Larissa Brown has been giving evidence on the unprecedented move to block journalists from reporting on and Parliament knowing about the leak that potentially put 100,000 Afghans who worked with the British at risk. Adnan Malik is from Barings Law, which represents around 1,000 of the victims.
Successive governments had the opportunity to hold the hand up, admit that there was a mistake, a grave mistake had been made, and remediational steps should have been taken before the super injunction was lifted. Why didn't they do that? There needs to be some consequences, unfortunately, because people have lost and paid with their lives.
The BBC has been accused of doctoring Donald Trump's speech on the day of the Capitol riots in 2021. Claims in a leaked document say footage was spliced together to make it look like the US president was calling for his followers to fight like hell, when he in fact told them to demonstrate peacefully and patriotically. Michael Preskus, a former external advisor to the BBC, compiled a dossier. Danny Cohen is a former director of BBC Television. He says the corporation has a structural liberal bias.
I think what's happened with Mr. Prescott is that he's witnessed over a number of years, he's been increasingly dismayed, not just by the failures, but by the reluctance and unwillingness of executives to address these failures and make change happen.
And flags at the White House have been lowered as it's announced Dick Cheney, who served as US Vice President under George W. Bush, has died at the age of 84. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, John Pienaar, at Drive, on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. How can a Chancellor's address to the nation be such a statement of the obvious and still so revealing? Taxes are going up in the budget. We knew that. We're going to be looking at Rachel Reeves' option, all of them bad, on today's show. But most people were resigned to another tax hike before Rachel Reeves said a word, according to a poll. There's not enough money to provide the public services that we want. Brexit left Britain weaker and worse off. The Chancellor and Nigel Farage agree on that, though not on who's to blame. And Labour inherited woefully underfunded public services. Now, hands up, who's shocked by any of that? No? Well, that's what I thought. So what did we learn? Well, quite a lot. I mean, not about Britain's economy, about the government and Britain's politics, and more from what the Chancellor didn't say than from what she did. The last budget's tax rises may well have slowed down the economy, but the government's political problems took root before that. Rachel Reeves insisted the true state of public finances came as a shock, and that's surely nonsense. Labour swore it wouldn't put up taxes before the election, and no one believed it then. And making the same promise again in office was risky at the very least, wasn't it? As for Brexit, Labour has kept pretty shtum about the cost of Brexit, till now, for fear of annoying Brexiteers. Now, in every case, Labour backed itself into a corner. The plan was to gather votes and support now and face the consequences later. There had to be a moment of reckoning, and that moment is just over 3 weeks away on Budget Day. I wonder what your hopes and fears are for this coming budget. Do send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. First then, let's have a chat to Anna Mikhailova, Times Radio's political editor. Hi to you, Anna.
Hi, John.
Hi, what are you thinking now then, Anna? The speech from Rachel Reeves, it was a blend of harsh realities and spin. Of course, the realities are harsh and the Chancellor's a politician, albeit a politician in a corner.
Well, let me tell you that in terms of how the Cabinet thinks this has landed, they are very pleased. They think that Rachel Reeves has done the right thing in essentially pre-briefing the first part of her budget speech. So the part where she sets the context and explains what decisions she has made. Normally, all of that is reserved for Budget Day, but effectively, she's done it in two parts. She's given us a preview of that. And the reasoning for this is, firstly, it tries to protect, it tries to get the public ready for coming tax rises. It tries to tell a story, makes Rachel Reeves look like she's on the front foot and not being led by events so much.
Yes.
Also, crucially, and this is why ministers like this, it allows them to now go out on the on the broadcast, in front of the media, to their constituents and say these lines, be able to use these talking points, because before they were really limited to just saying you'll have to wait for the budget. So they are happy. They think it's the right call by Rachel Reeves, and they do think that a lot more work needed to be done to prepare the public, because a lot of people who aren't following Westminster day to day are not necessarily aware of what is about to hit them in 3 weeks' time.
Right. So a round of applause from Cabinet colleagues. Now, do you get a sense of the feeling among Labour MPs? And how are they getting on with facing hard realities themselves, Anna? I mean, welfare, for example, welfare reform and savings, that's an important part of the formula. The government wants to do that. But the welfare plan ran into a wall of resistance. And there are other problems stacking up. Public sector pay, for example. Are Labour MPs realistic, to use that term, about all of that?
Well, MPs are pleased that Rachel Reeves was clear that she would not resort to public spending cuts. One of her main messages this morning was that she did not want to pursue austerity to plug the gap. So on that front, they will be happy because, of course, a lot of the discourse in Westminster is shifting towards saying that more cuts and welfare cuts are absolutely necessary to try and get a hold of get control of the public finances. But I think where MPs are much more wary is she has dropped the strongest hint